we'll have the marshal call the next resume court.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 21, 2021, and we are here for our second of four cases on our calendar this morning, A210134 Peterson versus Peterson. Counsel, I'm just going to ask you to mute your microphone when you're not speaking. You will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. These matters are being recorded, so I ask that you state your name and the client and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Hey, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Richard Crabb, and I'm the attorney of record for the appellant, Mr. John Peterson. My client is before the Court of Appeals today based on his request to reverse the district court's order denying his motion to terminate his spousal maintenance obligation based on the cohabitation of the respondent with her boyfriend. This case is the prime example of why the legislature amended MnStat 518.552 to include cohabitation as a basis for spousal maintenance.
Can you just tell me which one of the factual findings you believe are clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor.
And completely unsupported by the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for that question. So we do believe that, in fact, when the court reviewed all four of these sub-factors, that the court made clearly erroneous findings, specifically regarding the first sub-factor. The court...
Can you point me to the paragraphs and the findings of fact that you believe are clearly erroneous?
Certainly. Let me pull up that order, Your Honor.
I mean, because it seems to me, and the reason I'm asking this question is it seems to me as though the district court credited the testimony from the wife and her partner that they have no intention of getting married, that they reside at different places, that they have different addresses, and also the sister, they all testified to that information. And so I'm curious as to what is clearly erroneous about a finding that credits that testimony.
Your Honor, what's clearly erroneous is the fact that that finding is manifestly contrary to the great weight of the evidence. My client did present significant and voluminous evidence to the court regarding the first factor. He presented evidence that she had a sign outside her house that said, "Welcome to our home, Colleen and Greg." The other concern that I have is that if an obligee can overcome a motion to terminate spousal maintenance by cohabitation based merely on asserting that they're no longer cohabiting, that they never intend to remarry, that would render the entire statute unenforceable and meaningless if they can just simply overcome it by saying, "Oh, I'm never going to get married again," right?
That's not, I mean, to be fair, counsel, that's not the only evidence that she presented. They have different addresses, they have different leases, and there was some testimony.
Sure. And if we look at that lease, it's a very self-serving lease between the respondent's boyfriend and her parents, where the rent due is merely various duties. There's not even a dollar amount that he's paying. There's also evidence that the respondent's boyfriend was residing with her as recently as 1 week before the hearing on this matter. So there is evidence to the contrary of her assertions that the court failed to give due credit to. And that's the clear error by the court, Your Honor. Regarding the second sub-factor, the financial benefit derived by the respondent, my client produced evidence. Well, first off, the court made clear error in finding that there is no evidence that the respondent received an economic benefit from the cohabitation. There actually is evidence that my client did present. Specifically, there's $5,000 in cash deposits into the respondent's bank account. She never explained the origin for those. There's also Spectrum bills that were paid via credit card from November of 2018 through July of 2019. There's no corresponding invoices on the credit card statements or bank statements for those payments. She's also allegedly making some $600 per month payment to the IRS, but that's nowhere to be found in her bank statements. And there's also, there was a deposit into her bank account for 35 grand, which my client acknowledges was from him. But there's a withdrawal for approximately 25,000, but we don't know what that withdrawal was for because she didn't provide us the bank statements. She only provided the first page as one of her exhibits. So we don't know what that withdrawal is for or where it went. For all we know, there's another bank account out there that she's failed to disclose. That's the purpose behind this, Your Honor, is that it, even if the court finds that the district court didn't abuse its discretion, it still made an error of law by even addressing this motion and then denying it based on lack of evidence when the court previously denied my client's motion to compel discovery to get the evidence that he needed.
Mr. Crabb, stepping back again from some of those details, I mean, isn't the issue here or potentially the problem for you and your client the distinction between the past and the present? I mean, because the district court did make a finding that he, Mr. Silkey, I'm looking at paragraph 7 now, temporarily and intermittently resided with respondent for 23 months in the past. But then the district court also recognized that at the time of the motion, they had different addresses. The statute seems to be focused on the present, not the past. So I mean, what under the statute, what can a district judge do, district court do, if there was prior or cohabitation in the past, but not in the present?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a very astute question and something that we think is directly on point in our appeal is that cohabitation is not actually defined anywhere in this statute. And we do believe that cohabitation at any point provides a basis for the district court to terminate spousal maintenance. Now, the court does have to review the four sub-factors, but none of those four factors are determinative or controlling. So the court just needs to weigh those four together.
Is there some authority that supports that argument, counsel, that cohabitation at any point supports a maintenance change?
No, Your Honor. And part of the problem here is that we have a statute that was only amended in 2016. So there's really only one published case that interprets it, and that's the case of Cinda v. Cinda. And so that's part of the reason that we're here is that there is no clear definition of cohabitation either in the statute or in case law. And we believe that our definition, our proposed definition is a valid definition and that my client has met his burden on this case.
So what if wife decides to sell her house and can't find a new one and decides to move in with her partner for a 3-month period of time, finds a new house and then moves out? Are you saying that at some point after that episode, there can be a motion to modify the ongoing maintenance obligation based upon some period of time when the cohabitation occurred given the circumstances that may have presented themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's akin to somebody getting remarried and then getting divorced again in the future. So the fact that they're cohabiting or have cohabited provides a basis to bring this motion to terminate. And the court reviews those four factors to determine whether it's valid or not.
And you're conceding that there's no authority that would support that proposition about how maintenance would work in a prospective manner based on past behavior?
Yes, Your Honor. As I mentioned, that there's just not been enough time to really develop this, the case law and the statute on point. That's part of the reason that we're here this morning.
Mr. Crabb, the district court did reason in the alternative on page 68 of the addendum. The district court said, even if the respondent were currently cohabitating, petitioner has not satisfied the four factors. So it seems like, I mean, ultimately you have to sort of address those to prevail in your appeal. It seems to me that you have to show the district court erred in its analysis of those four factors. Agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree.
And could you focus on those?
Yep.
I mean, maybe you've already referred to them, I know, but I guess I feel like you need to address those to persuade us to reverse.
Understood, Your Honor. I will first dive in by saying that in the Cinda case, the holding was that an obligee's establishment of a long-term cohabitation arrangement with another adult after the dissolution constitutes a substantial change in circumstances. So we meet the first part of the test. It's a two-part test. The substantial change is met there by virtue of the fact that the respondent admitted in her answers to interrogatories that she had cohabited with her boyfriend for at least the 2 years prior to her answer. So then we move next to the second factor, whether it's fair or unreasonable for the obligation to continue. And so then we look at those four sub-factors. And again, with the first sub-factor, I've kind of addressed that already. I'll move on to the second sub-factor, which is regarding the actual economic benefit. I've mentioned a few things already about that, the credit card payments, the cash deposit. The respondent's boyfriend also has a brand new 2020 pickup truck that's registered to the respondent's address. So clearly there's a benefit that she's driving by being able to use this vehicle that's registered at her very own address. So we do believe that the court made an error in its finding that there's no evidence that she's received an economic benefit. We presented clear evidence of that. The third factor, the durability of the cohabitation, again, we've produced evidence that the respondent continues to reside with her boyfriend despite her assertions to the contrary. Of course, she's going to claim that she's not living with him or that she's not receiving any benefit from him because she would lose out on $2,000 of spousal maintenance each month. So we need to take a look at the motives and intentions behind her statements, not just her mere conjecture that she's no longer residing, especially with evidence to the contrary.
The district court made findings, I'm looking at paragraphs 11 and 12, about the current address of each of them, which is different. But what evidence was there I'm referring now to the third factor, that the likely future duration, based on that finding, it appears that there was no cohabitation based on the district court's findings in 11 and 12. I guess you would have to show that they were likely to revert back to cohabitation. Is that right?
Our argument is that they never stopped cohabiting, despite their assertions to the contrary, that their assertions are not credible, that the very fact that a week before the respondent's boyfriend was residing and spent the night at her house, and when he left in the morning, he left in the same direction that for work rather than going the other direction back to her parents. So clearly he has everything that he needs still at the respondent's residence because they're still cohabiting together. So we're not positing that they have to re-cohabit again. They've been cohabiting this entire time.
So I'm just trying to restate or to understand your argument. That argument, it seems to me, then depends upon your overturning some of the district court's factual findings. And I guess my question might have been along the lines of, if we assume the factual findings are not clearly erroneous, is there still a legal analysis that could result in your client's favor?
Yeah, even if you find that the court didn't make error in its findings, the very fact that the court held the hearing in and of itself is an error of law. This is based on the Matthias case that I previously cited to in my brief, that until an appellant has an opportunity to engage in reasonable discovery, the issues of modified support and maintenance were not ripe for consideration by the district court. And so they remanded on that issue to allow the appellant to proceed with reasonable discovery into the respondent's financial records. And so we're asking the same thing here. It's an either or, either reverse and say, nope, the court screwed up, made findings that were not supported by the record, that were manifestly contrary to the evidence in the record. Or if you're not going to make that finding or make that determination, then you need to remand it back to the district court for further discovery, because the court can't deny us the opportunity to prove our case and then deny our case because we didn't have the evidence to prove our case. It's tautological.
Could you please be as specific as possible about the discovery that was sought but not given? And because that in the appellate briefing, it seems like it's very general, but are there particular interrogatories or document requests that were not answered, and are they in the record, and were they, you know, was a very specific request made to the district court to postpone its ruling until we get a response to, you know, a specified discovery request?
Yes. So in the motion to compel, we asked not only for her to compel, for the court to compel her to answer the interrogatories and request for production of documents. But we also asked
which ones? I mean, are they numbered or are they, is there a date or?
The most relevant are the bank statements. She only provided 1 year's worth of bank statements instead of the 2 years that had been requested. The most relevant of those, I believe, is the May of 2018 bank statement that showed the 35,000 in and 25,000 out, but we don't know where that 25,000 out went. We also didn't get any continuing discovery, and she had a duty to supplement her discovery. So we didn't get any of the bank statements from July 2019 to present, which would potentially show the respondent continuing to provide financial support for her during that period of time.
But she did provide, and he provided alternative discovery, which was sworn affidavits as to their living conditions.
Again,
so why wouldn't additional so why wouldn't additional discovery just be cumulative? If she swore under oath and he swore under oath, what else do you need?
My client's entitled to the underlying records in order to impeach her testimony and impeach her sworn statements, because her statement that she's making are self-serving. And without those records to impeach them, the court can't really find them credible.
All right. Counsel, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Jana Alney-Deej, and I represent the respondent and the cross-appellant in this matter, Colleen Peterson. There are two orders under review today, and respondent respectfully requests that the July 14, 2020 order denying appellant's motion to compel discovery and the December 1, 2020 order that denied appellant's request to terminate spousal maintenance be upheld and affirmed by this court, as the district court properly denied both of those motions. Respondent does ask that this court remand the portion of the court's December 1, 2020 order that denied her request for need-based and conduct-based attorney's fees. This court reviews orders regarding discovery, spousal maintenance, and attorney's fees for abuse of discretion, and will reverse the court's decision only if the district court abused its broad discretion by reaching a clearly erroneous conclusion that is against the logic and the facts on the record. Appellant did not bring a motion for amended findings. Therefore, the questions before this court for review are whether the evidence sustains the findings of fact and whether such findings sustain the conclusions of law and judgment, and respondent respectfully argues that they do. Appellant has raised two issues on appeal. The first is regarding discovery. The second is regarding spousal maintenance, which I will address in a moment. Respondent's motion on or appeal is on the issue of attorney's fees and contends the district court erred when it denied her motion for attorney's fees and failed to make any findings or explain its reasons. We believe that the district court's failure to make specific findings on her request for attorney's fees amounts to legal error. First, regarding her request for need-based fees. The evidence that was presented to the district court required an award of need-based attorney's fees to the respondent. Pursuant to Minnesota Statute 518.14, the district court shall award attorney's fees in an amount necessary to enable a party to carry on or to contest a proceeding, provided it finds, one, that the fees were necessary for the good faith assertion of a party's rights and would not contribute unnecessarily to the length and expense of the proceeding. Secondly, that the party from whom fees are sought has the means to pay them. And third, the party to whom fees are awarded does not have the means to pay them. The use of the word shall in the statute mandates an award of need-based fees when the requesting party proves the factors in the statute. In the present case, the district court found that respondent has a monthly deficit of $1,383 in meeting her monthly living expenses. This is with her own earned income and with her spousal maintenance. If respondent is unable to meet her monthly living expenses, then it logically follows that she cannot afford the added expense of attorney's fees and litigation costs. Thus, respondent did not have the means to pay her own fees, and she has met one prong of the statute. The district court also found that appellant had benefited from a significant increase in income since the party's divorce. and respondent also produced evidence that appellant's expenses had reduced. Sufficient evidence was provided to the district court that appellant had the ability to contribute to respondent's fees, and the second prong was met. Respondent was forced to incur these attorney's fees in responding to appellant's demand to terminate her spousal maintenance and to address discovery issues. Appellant initiated all of litigation in this proceeding. Respondent had no choice but to defend against those motions, which included two motion hearings and discovery issues. The third prong of the statute is met. We believe respondent has met the statutory criteria for an award of need-based fees, and the district court erred in denying that request. Respondent also had a request for conduct-based fees, and the district court also had the discretion to award those fees against a party who unreasonably contributes to the length or expense of the proceeding, or against a party whose case is frivolous or in bad faith. We contend that appellant relentlessly pursued his efforts to terminate spousal maintenance, alleging that respondent was cohabitating even when he was presented with evidence that she was not. And furthermore, he continued to pursue his own legal theory that's unsubstantiated by Minnesota law that cohabitation on its own is sufficient to terminate spousal maintenance.
Is your claim for conduct-based fees based on the argument that the motion was frivolous?
We believe that the evidence showed that my client was not cohabitating. Therefore, the first prong of the statute regarding a substantial change in circumstances was not met, but that appellant pursued that legal theory anyway, basing it solely on this cohabitation argument, which was clearly erroneous.
Okay, I didn't really get an answer to my question. I mean, either you get conduct-based fees because he acted in bad faith or because the action was frivolous. Are you arguing both, one, the other, and what's the basis of the claim?
Certainly, Your Honor. We do believe that appellant pursued the issues in bad faith after the evidence overwhelmingly supported that my client was not cohabitating. And so that was a bad faith motion. It was also frivolous in terms of the discovery issues, as well as, again, just this relentless pursuit of the issue of cohabitation and this mandate that was not supported by Minnesota law that, based on cohabitation alone, that spousal maintenance should terminate.
So is the argument that after the motion was filed and once you produced evidence that the motion should have been withdrawn, and when it wasn't withdrawn, that's what amounts to frivolous and bad faith behavior? It's unclear to me what would trigger either or.
Your Honor, that's a very good question. So we believe that once the evidence was set forth and based on the court's denial of their request to obtain additional discovery, that it was clear that my client was not cohabitating and it was in bad faith to move forward with the motion to terminate spousal maintenance.
So I just want to be clear. You're not claiming that husband's acting in bad faith because of the investigation or the hiring of private investigators or going to wife's house and taking pictures of the front door, none of that. You're not arguing any of that.
We are not arguing that action alone was necessarily bad faith. I think it goes to the issue of discovery, which is one of the appellant's issues in terms of what discovery was produced and what information did he have. And again, knowing that, and I'm going to respond to counsel's comment regarding the allegation that my client was still cohabitating with her significant other 1 week prior to the August 27, 2020 hearing, which is patently untrue. As stated in my client's affidavit and was before the court, the party's son has a medical condition and is unable to drive. My client had just had back surgery, and it was arranged with the appellant's full knowledge that my client's significant other was going to drive the party's son to college that next morning. And essentially what appellant set up was a quote unquote gotcha, trying to make this argument that my client was cohabitating when he knew full well why her significant other was there, and it was to help the party's son. The court has no further questions on attorney's fees. I will turn the issue to the spousal maintenance. We contend the district court properly found that the respondent was not cohabitating and it did not abuse its broad discretion in denying appellant's motion. As the court has already stated, what the court did state was that the respondent's significant other and I'm quoting, temporarily and intermittently resided with her for a period of 23 months. The district court also found that during that same time period, her significant other also temporarily and intermittently resided with his sister, in addition to staying with other family and friends. And as this court has already stated, appellant continues to argue without citing any legal support that a spousal maintenance obligee's cohabitation with a significant other, past or present, is sufficient on its own to terminate spousal maintenance. That is at page 18 of appellant's principal brief. Appellant's argument is contrary to the plain language of the cohabitation statute, which requires the district court to analyze four separate factors only after an obligee's cohabitation has been established, and that's pursuant to the statute. It was not. This court has repeated—
Ms. Deitch?
Yes.
So the district judge's finding that Mr. Silkey temporarily and intermittently resided with respondent for a period of 23 months, is that cohabitation, yes or no?
I'd say no, Your Honor, it's not.
Why not? I mean, because it says they resided together.
They resided together. It is not a consistent forward. It wasn't ongoing. It was for periods of intermittent time. He would come, he would go, he would stay other places. The home that he had been living in was owned by his sister. It was sold. He needed a place to stay. So while he was bouncing around, he did stay with my client for periods of time, but he wasn't living with her consecutively for the entire 23 months. So we do not believe that that amounts to the level of cohabitation that would be required under the statute.
Let me ask a question, not so much about the facts of this case, but just about the law in general. Is cohabitation necessarily something that is yes, no, or is there, you know, all or none, or is there something in between? In other words, I mean, let's just say, you know, part-time cohabitation. Is that cohabitation, or is it not cohabitation because it's not 100% of the time? See, your argument seems to be that it's not cohabitation because it wasn't 100%. But I'm not sure whether it's the law requires 100% of the time in order to have a finding of cohabitation. And anyway, please go ahead.
And I think the answer to that question, Your Honor, is it's going to be very fact specific from case to case. In some cases, to find somebody has lived every single day for the last 23 months or 24 months or whatever period is at issue, it could be considered cohabitation, would likely be considered cohabitation. And if parties live together sporadically, for example, if somebody traveled heavily for work and was gone periods of time, but that was their primary residence where their clothing and belongings, and basically that was their base coming and going, the court could find that it was cohabitation. But I think in this case, given my client's significant other did not like move everything in, he was not living there consistently, he was moving around, I think the court was within its discretion to say that it was not cohabitation, it was just temporarily residing with her.
So is there evidence in the record about his property, personal property possessions, where they were located?
Your Honor, I don't recall specifically off the top of my head. I do believe that there was evidence that was provided that Mr. Silkey moved from place to place where the bulk of his belongings were. I do not believe that that was specifically addressed in the record. I will go on to address the issue of the cohabitation. Mr. Crabb raised the issue of the published decision of Cinda v. Cinda, and this court specifically stated and concluded that a maintenance obligee's cohabitation with another adult constitutes a substantial change in circumstances that justifies modifying maintenance if, and that's the key word in that sentence, consideration of the four factors enumerated in the statute indicates that cohabitation makes the existing maintenance obligation unreasonable and unfair. So contrary to counsel's argument, cohabitation standing alone is an insufficient basis to modify or terminate spousal maintenance. As the decision in Cinda confirmed, a spousal maintenance obligor who is alleging cohabitation is still not excused from meeting his evidentiary burden under the standard two-part spousal maintenance modification test, which requires one, proving present cohabitation. We believe that the language in the statute indicates present cohabitation. And that secondly, based on the factors in the statute, that the cohabitation makes the spousal maintenance obligation unreasonable and unfair. We respectfully contend that appellant failed to move past the first factor of this analysis because the respondent was not cohabitating and the court found that. Hypothetically, even if the court had agreed that my client had been cohabitating, he still failed on his motion based on the four-part factors that had to be analyzed under the statute, which the court did analyze. The court went on to say, I don't find she's cohabitating, but I'll look at these factors anyway. Number one, the first factor, there was no intention to marry. Both respondent and her significant other testified in sworn affidavits they had no intention to marry. My client was very clear. She has no intention to marry anyone ever. So even if she had been, cohabitated, and even if she had said, yeah, I think maybe one day we'll get married, that still is not fatal to her claim for spousal maintenance. There was no economic benefit derived from the relationship. The allegations and the conjecture by counsel don't support any of the factual information in the record. Mr. Silkie did not pay the mortgage. He did not contribute to significant expenses while they were residing together. There is no current cohabitation. And the district court properly found that terminating spousal maintenance would have had a negative effect on respondent, given the fact that she was already having experienced a negative deficit in her trying to meet her monthly expenses with her own income and with the spousal maintenance. And that if there had been a termination or modification of spousal maintenance, it would have been a significantly detrimental impact on respondent.
Ms. Deitch, Judge Frisch, may I ask one more question of
Ms. Deitch?
Yes. So related to your last point, Ms. Deitch, I mean, the second factor regarding cohabitation is the economic benefit the obligee derives from the cohabitation. It seems like, but your client did not produce bank statements for the second half of that 23-month period. I mean, how can the moving party put in favorable evidence about economic benefit without those bank statements?
And Your Honor, my client did provide bank statements. I don't have in front of me exactly, did she provide every single statement for the 24-month period that was requested? I do believe she provided the majority of those statements. And in looking through those statements, it is very clear that she is, and she alone, is paying her monthly living expenses. And to to counsel's argument regarding supplementing the record, there was no request for supplementation that was made. And the additional discovery that was part of the motion to compel discovery included information that was not asked for as part of formal discovery. It was information that didn't exist, such as this fabricated savings account that was really an overdraft account for my client, or asking for her significant other's financial information, which, you know, he's not a party to the action. My client had no legal authority to obtain this information and turn it over. And appellant he had over a year to pursue discovery, which he didn't do. He chose not to take depositions, and he can't now turn that around and blame the district court to say he didn't have an opportunity for discovery and to obtain any information he needed. He had plenty of time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Deitch.
Thank you.
Mr. Crabb. You're muted, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the issue of attorney's fees, my client is requesting that the Court of Appeals affirms the district court's order regarding attorney's fees. The respondent is claiming that she is entitled to need-based attorney's fees based on her alleged shortfall of $1,383 per month. But there's a problem there, because if she actually had that shortfall, then where is that shortfall being paid for? How is it being paid? It would have to go on credit cards. But if you look to the evidence and the exhibits, she actually paid her Best Buy credit card balance down from $2,192 in November of 2018 to $1,751 in July of 2019. And her Delta American Express credit card is her other credit card. And that balance only increased by about $1,000 between December of 2018, when it was $927, and July of 2019, when it went up to $2,399. So her claims that she has a monthly shortfall of $1,383 demonstrates that she's either lying about her budget or she's lying about the fact that her boyfriend is contributing towards her living expenses, because there's no significant debt there. There should be tens of thousands of dollars worth of credit card debt if she were actually incurring this claimed shortfall. She never provided any verification.
Mr. Crabb, I'm going to ask you to address the argument that Ms. Deitch made and one that I was going to ask you about earlier. Under CINDA, even if you demonstrate the four factors, you still have to demonstrate that the ongoing maintenance obligation is unreasonable and unfair. And I didn't see any argument in your brief addressing that issue. And I'm concerned about that issue, especially in light of the fact that your client makes almost three times as much money as wife. Do you want to address that?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. First off, my client's income has absolutely no bearing or consideration on his motion to terminate for cohabitation. The court strictly needs to look at the respondent's her cohabitation, the continuing cohabitation, the financial benefits she gets. Those four sub-factors are what the court considers when determining whether the ongoing amount is unreasonable and unfair. And so in my brief, I briefed those four sub-factors, and those four sub-factors are relevant to the unreasonableness and unfairness of the ongoing obligation. And so I apologize if that was not clear to the Court of Appeals, but that's what we need to prove in order to prove that it's unreasonable and unfair, is those four sub-factors, which I did brief in my briefs, and I've explained during my oral argument here today, that we do not believe that the court's findings are appropriate. They're clearly erroneous. They're manifestly against the great weight of the evidence, and therefore it abuses the court's discretion to have made those findings. The bottom line is that the respondent and her boyfriend are continuing to cohabitate. It's completely unreasonable to say that you're in a committed relationship, but you derive no economic benefit from each other. That just belies common sense, Your Honor. I do want to highlight a couple other things about the bad faith claim for conduct-based attorney's fees, if I may now, Your Honor. CINDA did specifically hold that once you've proven cohabitation, you can carry on with your motion and try to prove the four underlying sub-factors. So my client did not engage in any bad faith or frivolous argument here. The respondent herself, in her own interrogatory, answered, and she indicated that my friend Greg Silkey resided with me from August 2017 to July 22nd, 2019. She did not say intermittently. She did not say here, now, sometimes. She said that entire time period under oath in her answer to interrogatories. That is lock solid proof and evidence that my client provided the cohabitation. And so for the court to then make a finding that he only intermittently resided with her is clear error by the court and manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence. And so my client was certainly entitled to pursue his motion based on her admission there. I do want to point out that regarding that gotcha that opposing counsel is claiming that my client's engaged in, the respondent informed my client that her boyfriend would provide transportation for their son on Monday, August 17th of 2020, not Friday, August 21st of 2020, when my client actually hired the private investigator and observed the respondent's boyfriend leaving. And so it was a completely different day. So there's no gotcha moment here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Crabb, I see that your time has expired. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted and we'll issue an opinion within the statutory time period.